of the legislative session.
The 101st day of the legislative session, and we have a quorum. We have Representative Martin, Representative Davidson, Representative Davis, myself, Max Gruenberg, and I thought I saw Representative Ellis.
His aide just came in and...
I see. He has not yet. We have several bills on the calendar today. We have House Bill 192 on absentee ballots. We have House Bill, Senate Bill 43 on elections. And we have House Bill 175 on various children's procedures. We also have other items that may be brought up for discussion, including House Bills 238 and House Bill 121. The first bill I would like to take, I see, note for the record that Representative Ellis is present. First bill we have on the calendar is Senate Bill 43, and we have Senator Porchot, the prime sponsor. Senator, would you care to join us?
Are we on telecom?
No.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate you taking up this bill and also accommodating me. I have my own committee that started 5 minutes ago without me. I appreciate you taking the bill up.
Often I find that committees do better when I'm absent.
It may very well be the case in our situation also. The bill before you makes a number of changes to the state's election code. A majority of these provisions have been around for the last 2 years. I think members of this committee probably remember and recall some of these. It did pass the House. It died in the final days of the session in the Senate Rules Committee after going through all the Senate committees. In addition to the provisions of the old bill, there are some additional provisions that have been suggested by the Division of Elections and a couple of issues that have been raised in the last round of primary and general elections. These provisions I would have to characterize as technical and, at least so far in the process, non-controversial. The bill passed unanimously in the Senate, has been through another House committee, and most of the provisions have been fairly well studied. I would point out a couple of provisions that deal with money issues. One is the deletion of the requirement for separate judicial ballots. In the old days when we had closed primaries, ballots for the judiciary were considered the law required them to be on separate ballots or separate pieces of paper. Since the time we've gone to an open primary, this nonpartisan nature of the ballot has really become a moot point, and it would save some considerable thousands of dollars to be able to print on the same ballot other measures in addition to whether a judge was retained or not. There's another provision deleting plus marks that's required in statutes from the ballot. This in districts that use both computer and hand mark, this requires the printing of two different ballots, one with plus marks and one without, for hand marking. Elimination of that would cause no problem and would save some money. There is a provision that was supported last year by the chairman and Representative Donnelly from that same district, dealing with notification of any precinct polling place changes or district boundary changes to all the people affected. That's retained in the bill. It would require...
Passed last year.
Sorry?
That provision passed.
Most of these provisions passed last year. They were not enacted in final law. The bill died in the final hours in the Senate Rules Committee. That's why you see it in the bill before you, that unfortunately these were not enacted. So that does involve a little cost to the extent that precinct location voting changes or boundaries change. And so the effects of those make for a zero fiscal note, but there are some efficiencies built into the kinds of changes we're provided here. And I would say to the committee, without endangering enfranchisement or the voting rights of citizens of Alaska. Ms. Edgeworth from the Division of Elections is here and is thoroughly knowledgeable about all the ins and outs of the various provisions. I'm sure Ms. Edgeworth would be happy to answer any questions or explain them further.
Mr. Redmond, where's the provision that I was just asking about?
That would be section five.
Well, I thought that something passed with that in there.
It died in rules. It passed one house and died in the final hours of session of the other meeting.
Mr. Porcio, I have just two questions. Number one, have you taken a look at the House bill that dealt with elections and so forth, court-ordered elections and witnessing of absentee ballots?
I have not studied the bill. It's been briefed to me, but several weeks ago.
It's my hope that unless issues come up that I'm not aware of, you know, that we'll be able to move on this pretty promptly. And I was wondering if, between now and the next hearing, if maybe you could take a look at the House Judiciary bill, because just for housekeeping purposes, I think there's some elements of it that would be very suitable to this bill, and maybe even so much so that it would be worth the trouble of a concurrent resolution to allow them to be fitted in under the title. But I would leave that judgment to you and ask if you just take a look at it and see if you think it's appropriate for an amendment.
Okay, I would take a look at them. I do understand there is a title problem. And I'd have to be honest with the committee. There is a perception, potential perception problem that I wrestled with in carrying the bill through the Senate. The view, and again, this is through my eyes, I'm characterizing what I sense is a feeling in the Senate or the other body that changes not being made that somehow would favor or not favor the kind of outcome that occurred in the special election, that they wanted an election bill that was neutral on those points. Now, having said that, there are a couple of provisions in this bill that clarify or address some of the problems, notably in section one, this was something that our law was frankly a little bit contradictory to the national standards for requiring registration information. The federal forms that many military people got were not requiring the same information that our own standards were, and so there were conflicts with federal and state registration forms. In section one, we've checked and actually had testimony by the federal military official in charge of reviewing state election laws, and they said that yes, this would better meet the federal standards for registration information. In addition, a provision that doesn't appear in the bill, but it was done administratively or is to be done administratively by elections, would restructure the ballot, outside ballot envelope, on how witnessing is required to try to avoid some of the procedural issues that were raised in the court challenge on the recent special, or necessitating the recent special election. So there have been some steps made to clarify those most obvious things that everybody could agree to, clarified it. I understand, I mean, my recollection from your amendments that attempted to do the same thing, although I would hesitate if it was perceived that somehow favored or would have changed an outcome in the most recent election. It would be viewed in a hostile way.
Understood. And I agree with not only, I mean, that seems right to me that we don't want to color outcomes of elections through our action. I do have a copy of the bill. Maybe as the other folks speak, you have a chance to take a look at it. But the one element that might not require a title change indicates simply that the signature on an absentee ballot must be the same day, witnessed the same day as it was signed, which was already implemented by the courts. And this is just to clarify that is our standard. That would be one thing maybe you'd like to take a look at. I think the other one probably would require a title change, and you might want to, I don't know, you'll just share with us your feelings at the appropriate time, but it basically just indicates when, you know, the time frame in which the court would order a new election. Essentially, it was intended to simply put in statute what is already being done in practice to allow the court to order a new election. So I'll pass this down to you for your review and comment, and we don't need it today, but I'd appreciate your thoughts. I have one other question before I take Mr. Martin, if I may, and that was on the absentee ballot itself. I was just wondering if you if you had noticed that the name of the voter is no longer required on the absentee ballot, only the signature.
and what section we are.
I'm sorry, let me find the ballot itself here. I just was looking in your packet here, the bill packet, where this thing is included. Is this it? Where's the one that, oh, here we go. And it asks for the address, birth date, signature, et cetera, but it doesn't ask for the name. And I was just wondering whether you thought there was any value in addressing an issue like that in legislation, since the regulations don't require people to put their name on the absentee ballot.
Well, I would defer to Ms. Edgeworth. I would just say if they could, it seems like if they can't read the signature, the person's name couldn't be checked off as a validly registered voter, and so
that's my point, that a person's handwriting would have a bearing on their right to vote.
I would defer that question really to Ms. Edgeworth.
I'll defer. Thank you. Mr. Morton?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I only have a couple questions. I'll ask Ms. Linda a couple, much of them, but from your experience and my experience, and each lesson is well run with me, I put in down on page 6, line 28. We seem to have changed that, but not as strong as I would like. The length of residency in the state and in the district of the candidate, fine. But I'd like to make it stronger that the candidate is saying he or she meets the requirement of the length
of
residency.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin, of course, this is only, you know, certain portions of the statute. What you don't see, and you may recall from your own declaration, is that after this requirement is on the form above, you do indeed certify that all the information above is true and accurate, that your signature on your declaration mm-hmm. of candidacy is exactly what you're talking about, that you do attest to all of those things being true. What we're trying to get at here is that even though the declaration of candidacies now include length of residency and in the district, it's not required by statute. And so what we've done here is just to make sure that in the future that indeed that information is required. Now, presumably, someone reading the statute now could, just like with a social security number, choose not to fill in that blank. I mean, I assume they could say it's not required under the statute and I'm not filling it in. They would still be signing that they were bona fide, they met the requirements of the office, which of course, you know, include a year of residency in the district.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to flag that one because I really think that's important. Sure, they sign the bottom of it. When they're filling out each of these questions, you have the individual becoming conscientious step by step. And this one here, I'm not just putting down there, I live for 2 months, but suddenly I'm aware, I meet the requirement. Well, what's the requirement? So I don't mind what used to be in there, I meet the requirement. It makes me wonder, well, what are the requirements? You're doing another section of law for sure. But to the best of that individual's abilities right here, he's just putting his length in his state. Nothing alerts him to look up the law. Secondly, and this is just for a story to it, because I know we'll get into it later, Senator. One of the problems that we have in the Division of Election had it, and Legal Service had it too, I don't think a candidate should verify and certify their own forms of any nature. And I'd like to bring that up to Ms. Ellsworth and others so that we don't have that problem again. That everyone else, an innocent person on a submarine must run around and get two people to swear that he signed on a certain date. But the candidate can put anything on that doggone thing and swear to the truth. And they said because it was certified, well, it was called the Department of Law, but it was certified. But it was certified by the same person, the candidate. I think you should have two people involved there somehow.
Mr. Chairman? I think what Representative Martin is referring to is actually not the Declaration of Candidacy, but a change of address on a mm-hmm. registration form. We had an extensive discussion on this in the House State Affairs Committee, and frankly, that is actually kind of a moot point because you don't need to be, not only do you not need to sign something, or let alone your own, you can pick up the phone and call in a change of address. That the requirements for changing mm-hmm. address are meant to be easy. They're meant to have people update their voter registration. It doesn't, they've already met the requirements for registration. They've already been in a district so long. So they've already...
We don't know that in the last case.
Well, they've already had the registration on file, so it's only, you know, a bookkeeping or an accounting updating of their address change. They can fill out something. They don't need to have it witnessed by two people for changing an address.
Okay, well...
We'll have to get into specifics on that.
I was thinking that, you know, you may decide you have an amendment to make, or maybe Ms. Edgeworth will be able to answer your questions, Mr. Martin. Mr. Davis, before I call on you, Senator, what we're going to try to do is cover the bill, maybe have you take us through it. Mr. Gruenberg indicated he'd like a quick run-through. If you didn't do that before I already arrived, had you?
I hit some of the highlights. There's a number of sections. I think you should have a summary of
maybe
those.
Maybe we could get just a real quick run-through when Max returns to the table. And what I'd like to do is, you know, deal with it a little longer, get the preliminary questions answered, take testimony, because we've got some folks on the teleconference line on another bill, and we have a third bill to deal with today. So I'd like to try to frame all the issues and get everything on the table. There doesn't seem like there are any real issues.
Mr. Chairman, I did have a response, though, on your first question.
Oh, thank you.
The voter number that's shown here is keyed into the registration number and the person's name. So there's no danger of not having... To fill in the voter number, they've got their little card with them that they're filling that number in. And so
I guess my concern was that many people don't have their card and don't know their voter number. And it says provide at least one of the following, which means they could just provide their birth date. And although I'm sure it is possible for the Division of Elections to compare signatures based on birth dates, I just can't think of any public policy justification for not having to put their name on here so that they wouldn't have to go through the extra work. On the other hand, it's just something I noticed, and it's not exactly an issue I'm going to live or die behind, but maybe we could find a way to deal with it, and maybe the division could just tell us they're going to fix it next time. It's no big thing. One thing, Pat, if you had a chance to look at that 192, I was thinking maybe the first section that deals with witnessing would be appropriate to this bill and might be useful. Mr. Davis has a question.
Okay. I have several questions, and I'll try to be brief on this. One has to do with the 30-day requirement that it has to be received. And I guess, Senator, what my concern is on that is that I'd like to see same-day registration. That would be my wish. And what we have now, what we will have now, is an uneven... not that it will be very uniform with everybody that arrives, but if you were, like we do during the summer, we try to get people out to register for the fair, we set a deadline, it's, you know, this date, and have to be signed on that date, and so they, and or send them in or whatever. So you have a lot of volunteers out there that may get them in 3 or 4 days later, which I know is probably a little problem, but I think this would tend to... it may tend to limit the amount of people that are registering to vote, so that is a concern. And I know that Max is back. I have a couple other questions, but I think I'll wait, let you do the walkthrough, and then if I have questions, I'll ask them.
Very good. What I'd like to try to do is maybe spend 10, 12, 13 more minutes, unless something comes up that requires more attention. I think the issues in the bill are pretty clear. Mr. Gruenberg has an amendment that seems to be technical in nature. I have a possible amendment that you have before you in 192. Max, I asked Pat if you would run us once through the bill section by section.
Sure.
You both would just be free with one another, and we'll move us along that way as fast as possible. Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I would direct the attention to a couple of things. One is this color-coded summary of several of the more significant provisions provided by the Division of Elections. The second is a memorandum from me to the members of the committee dated April 5th that outlined by section number the different provisions, and I can walk through that, and I think that has the advantage of several sections of the bill relate to one particular change, and that lumps those things together.
Senator, you're talking about a memo?
this thing with the little colored pages.
Well, you're talking about something else, something dated April.
Oh. Pat, you've got a couple of minutes in here too somewhere.
No, but there's something else you were talking about.
It's a cover memo on your packet.
It's in the blue deal?
Sorry.
I see.
The blue book.
Okay. Okay, thank you. This is colorful, I like it.
It was Easter.
Did you want me to go through all those?
Max, this is whatever you want here, sir.
Yeah, why don't you just walk us through it, sir?
Okay, the, in section one, I mentioned that one before, that was the, our state registr, our state, registration form required more information than the federal form. If it didn't have it on there, it was returned for filling in. Some people were disenfranchised through this process, just through this communication back and forth. This would change it to, not require certain information unless requested. And obviously this is to be able to do the checks. If you don't think somebody is a bona fide resident, you can require them to submit additional documentation. But you wouldn't reject out of hand like we've been doing now so many registration forms that where the federal, they were turning in the federal form for registration, but it lacked the some of the statutory information that the state required on its form. So this would make those consistent. But we would still have the ability to request additional information.
On that point, Mr. Martin, makes think, has that been corrected? One of the questions they had is someone had put the precinct number in there. I doubt if half the people, even 10%, if you go around, they know the precinct number. And I thought that here you got some kids on a ship or a wife out with a husband in West Germany, and she sends a form in and it forgets her precinct number. You know, come on. You don't do it in town. Why do somebody stay from West Germany? We still have that problem? Or?
No one has ever been rejected because they didn't have a precinct number.
Someone, we were told we were rejected.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but if you're okay. Let's wait till they get to the table and
all right,
we'll
that's
do it.
No more of that or any other questions. The other one was your old physical address, and some said they didn't have a physical address but they want a base in a building.
Mr. Porcio, okay. If you have a comment. Okay. Would you continue to take us through? Let's hold questions now until you've had a chance to get to the bill.
Section 2 and 3, again, we've mentioned this one before. Representative Davis brought this up. This establishes a firmer cutoff for registration forms, for registration. The problem is, you can, because of the mail situation, you don't know between the 30 days and the election day, really, when you're going to get in registration forms in the mail. The problem becomes at some point, you've got to put the rolls to bed. You've got to have the printout of all the new registrants. So when the people show up at the poll, if they think they registered, it came in, 4 days before the election, their name's not going to be on the roll. It will facilitate having an accurate roll, reduce the number of question ballots. Yes, the net effect will probably be to change on average the registration period 2 or 3 days. But as far as the voter registration drives, those could all be geared accordingly. You move it up 2 or 3 days, you go the weekend before. But rather than the registrars like myself and many of you just kind of casually dropping your new registrants in the mail, you take them down to the elections, or in Peter's case, you know, send them overnight mail or express mail to Juneau. And I mean, you just have to recalculate your time frame a little differently. It really doesn't, it shouldn't impact the number of people on a last minute voter registration drive. You just have to back out your days a little bit and take care of your mailing and your direct deposit of things a little bit better. The section 4 came out of the Ewling-Fisher race, where there was a question on how do you treat, should you disqualify women's votes if they change their name, and this makes the policy of the court clear that you can allow a name change by voting a question ballot and then double checking to see if they voted under their old, or they were registered under an old name. It has the effect of enfranchising people that might otherwise get dropped to a name change. Section 5 is the precinct boundary change that we talked about earlier. Section 6, 23 and 26, again, I mentioned would relate to the judicial retention requirement that they don't have to be on separate ballots, and it's a cost savings. Section 7, there's a, in the statute, there's this mention that you have to record the time that a absentee ballot was received, date and time. It just removes the word time. There's no reason for that. The date is sufficient. Section 8 would extend the application period for absentee ballot. We had a big debate on the floor on this, and there was a lot of confusion on this. The net effect of this is to increase the ability to return absentee ballots. Rather than saying something has to be postmarked 10 days prior to election, I'm sorry, to receive an absentee ballot, if elections now receives a ballot 6 days before the election, they have time physically to mail back the absentee ballot, but under a strict reading of the law, they'd say, nope, it wasn't postmarked 10 days before. What this would do would be to say that on all absentee ballot requests received by the Friday before the election will, to the best of their ability, be gathered up, and a ballot will be sent to them on Saturday. Hopefully that would be enough time to allow most people, not all people, but most people, to receive an absentee ballot to be voted by election day. So it's a more clear-cut, practical way of handling absentee ballot requests.
Mr. Davis, I'll let you go through the whole thing.
Let's go through it once. It's a long bill, but let's go through it. I've got some indications that members may not be ill-disposed to moving it, so if you want to take some time on it, let's go through it once first and then see where we go after that. Go ahead, Thomas. Okay. Let's try to move right along.
The sections 9 through 12 remove a conflict in the statute on counting of absentee ballots. Two sections of the bill that relate to absentee ballots. We have a 10-day cutoff for the return of absentee ballots mailed in the country and a 15-day out of state. That's kind of one section. Another section talks about what you do, what you count in a recount situation. What we want to do, the intent of the law is to count all ballots regardless of when they're returned in a recount situation. The wording, because it was changed a couple of years ago, did not mimic the same language in the recount situation as in the main provision. This would make it consistent, so that the net effect would be, in a regular election, all ballots in country would be counted if they were received 10 days after the election, 15 days for FBO, APO, or out of country. In a recount situation, all ballots received up to the date of the recount would be counted. So this makes that consistent for the 10 and the 15 days. They left out the 10 and the 15, the 10 days. The section 13, again, I discussed with the plus sign, which saves some money. Section 14 would, Representative Martin's one he pointed out, where it would put in statute residency requirements on the declaration of candidacy. Even though they're there now, this would put it in statute. Section 14 removes an ambiguity in the statute where you are declaring that you have not filed another declaration of candidacy for the office for which the current declaration is filed. You have people who switch, either party registration for this, and they file for the same office. Taken literally, no candidate could withdraw or change his declaration up even before the cutoff date. What this does is remove that provision and make it clear that's permissible. But that, Mr. Chairman, is one of the amendments that I've submitted. We thought we took care of the problem by I want to make sure I say this right. For the normal situation where we go down and we file a declaration of candidacy, we thought we took care of it in that section because in there it was clear that you couldn't file for dual office because you weren't registered. You can't be registered in two parties at the same time. What we neglected to take into account was the other situation by party, by petition, you can file as a candidate by, on a non, you know, a third party candidate, or you can file a petition. We did not include, or we did not take into account that situation so that it conceivably would be possible for someone to file as both a Republican and a Democrat through a petition process for the same office. And the amendment that I've submitted takes care of that additional situation. It isn't a problem yet, but conceivably it could be a problem. The effect of what we're trying to do here is to allow people to legitimately withdraw from an office, or in the case of Kurt Menard, you know, as an example, you know, someone who switches from an R to a D, but for the same office, but not allow people to file two documents or two declarations or two petitions as both an R and a D for the same office. That clearly is not the intent, so we want to make sure that doesn't happen.
As I understand it, the language lets you go from an R to D, but not vice versa.
Well, that's essential.
Is that fair?
It's in the small print.
What section are we up to?
Section 14.
14.
Go ahead.
No, I was just voting for that amendment.
Thanks. Okay. Go ahead. Unanimous consent. Sorry, Terry.
Section 14 also would permit the filing of both our APOC conflict of interest and candidacies on the same date before it says simultaneously. In some places, you go to different offices to file it, and I know myself, I've often filed for declaration and then said, I'm taking my APOC conflict of interest across town, and they've been allowing that, but this would make it consistent with statute to be able to do that on the same date. Section 15, 16, and 19, and through 19, and section 22 concern removal of names from a primary ballot. And we've moved the date from 40 days before the election to 48 days. Basically, the printing gets so complicated in a primary, and the printing dates get so squished and they have to wait until the last possible moment when a guy can withdraw from the ballot. This moves that up in that decision date up in time, simply to allow easier printing. In some cases, avoiding overtime charges on printing, because the things have to be printed so fast, and they are fairly complicated when you have, you know, you have to rotate. For example, when Sheffield in 6, when we had 16 gubernatorial candidates under Alaska law, we have to rotate those. A very complicated printing process, takes time, and we can get into overtime situations. It costs us more money. Let's see, section 16. This is actually kind of a conforming amendment to when someone withdraws from an office, the party. For certain reasons, a party is sometimes able to replace that person on the ballot, like in the case when one of your people withdrew from an election here this fall, and the losing candidate of another election was placed on the ballot in his stead. That time frame has to be adjusted according to the 40 to 48 day period of time.
The last world I remember him well.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The section 20. This is probably a substantive change, and frankly, it stems from a court suit that was done last year, where the court allowed third-party candidates to be placed on the ballot after the primary election. In the Senate, there was considerable concern about this situation and the precedent it might set in the future. We unanimously felt that you needed to pay attention to the court suit. They clearly said that it's a third party person was not to be bound by the June 1 filing date. So we frankly picked an arbitrary date that would allow additional time for a third party person to file for office and be on the ballot, but again, arbitrarily, felt that that date should not be, be after the primary, that people have to make their intentions known before the primary so that you don't get all the losers in the primary refiling as third-party candidates in the general election. So we picked a date of August 1 for a cutoff date for third-party candidates to file for office. And this went a step towards meeting the rationale of the court decision as best we could make it out. But clearly, there's no right or wrong to it. It's an arbitrary date. It's something that, you know, many of us can agree to, but perhaps might be challenged later on. It just, I think you just have to, you know, be aware of that.
Senator, could you just to make sure I don't miss anything, exactly, can you just mention all the lines and pages on which that issue is treated in any sense? Is it just the Section 20 or
just Section 20?
And the court decision, as you read it, just simply says that June 1st is too early and we've got to fix it.
June 1st is too early. There was a lot of case law in other states that allowed for later filing. The problem was very few states have as late a primary as we do.
Okay.
So it, as late a primary as we do. We often,
thank
so.
You. Thank you.
Yeah.
I just wanted to just confirm that.
I have just one more.
That's what I want to let you get through.
Just the last section, Section 21. This is a similar provision to the other one as far as requiring statute the requirement for the residency address and length of residency on a nominating petition. This is similar language to the other to the declaration of candidacy requirements. Ms. Merrifield.
Thanks a lot. We've got a group of questions. I think I'll just go clockwise. Mr. Davis? Mike, you have any questions?
Yeah. Let's just go back to the first question I had dealing with the 30 days.
Right.
Now, did you consider, your arguments are certainly good, and by the way, I appreciate your work on this piece of legislation. I think it's certainly needed. But given the fact that there's going to be some confusion on it, did you consider having this 30-day requirement that it be postmarked by 30 days or be in the office by, you know, 27 or something like that? I think given...
You mean and that it be in the office by a certain
date? Not postmarked. You removed the postmark date.
Received.
Yeah. Received at a somewhat later date, but a definite
exactly.
date.
Just we, because of the there's going to be confusion. People are going to fall out, and you know, people are going to so address the issue, but not change the law really.
So you would say you have to be registered by 30 days, and it has to be
and
received.
Or it has to be postmarked by 30 days. And you said in here that third and building have a postmark anyway, or be received in the office by a reasonable time. Address the issue, and frankly, you know, as I said before, I think we're in the business of trying to franchise people, not disenfranchise people. And so it would address the issue, make it definite, but it wouldn't necessarily have people fall out.
Mr. Porcher, do you wish to comment?
Well, you know, I've been handed something. I'm not sure I'm going to hack it.
Would you like to give that a little consideration?
Yeah, I think I'd like to have Linda Edgeworth answer that question because she deals with the practical aspects of what that means. I'm not sure you can. What we found in a lot of these things is you have to pick a day, and it's got to be fairly arbitrary. Otherwise, if you're relying on postmarks at all, mm-hmm. your system gets real sketchy real fast because a third of them don't have, as you stated, don't have postmarks. So you're picking a date of receipt. So the real choice, it seems like, is you're either picking 30 days or 27 days or whatever. But once you start getting down there, it becomes harder and harder to re-enter all these names because, as you know, you get hundreds and hundreds of new registrants in that 30-day period. all those have to be entered, the new runs have to be made, you know, candidates are screaming for them by the, you know, they want to do their last mailing based on them. You've got to have a cutoff date where elections can physically do their work before the election. And so I think you're at a problem, and then you're going to cut off, you know, some people with it who get their, you know, kind of trickles in, and then they've got a problem too,
right,
when they go to vote.
Well, see, I mean, if I was writing a law, I'd have same day registration. I think there's a number of states that do that, so I don't, it's not something that states aren't done. So why, from my perspective, why make it 30 days and leave out those people that are now getting caught, the people that are registered by 30 days? So this is effectively making the registration maybe 33 days or 34 days, or at least a certain part of those people.
Well, the mail-in portion would be, have to back up a little
exactly.
bit,
yeah.
But
this is
for a lot of communities, and I don't, you know, in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau, frankly, it's no more problem to run your registration slips down after that. You go from the shopping mall down to divisional elections, they're open the last weekend.
Do they have to be 30 days? Is this new law going to happen 30 days?
It's still 30 days. It's still 30 days. It's just a matter of when they're received by elections.
I can listen to what the elections have on that, but it's a concern of mine. And let me just take this next one. Has to do with, and I'm not familiar with this, Mr. Bouchon, I'm sorry if I didn't hear this, but the federal postcard application, is that the same day registration for military? Is that what that federal postcard application?
It's, they have to abide by the same time frames as in-state residents or non-military people do. It's just that the military provides a universal application form that you could get in any military base in the world, and they say, if you're not registered, send this in to your local state. They send it in, and what's been happening is there's different information requested on the federal, or not requested on the federal form, that's required or requested on the state form.
I guess, and this is more information, and what I'm saying is that like in a presidential election anyway, I know that people can register the same day and vote, right? And
not
it doesn't do that.
No.
I see.
This is, instead of having 50 forms in a submarine, they have one form.
My understanding is a number of people, military people, that registered and voted the same day, but I can talk to the election about that. The other question I have has to do with this absentee ballot of 4 days versus 10 days.
Right.
Now, are we going to be in a situation where we're sending something out, as you said, the Friday before the election,
right,
and someone can then attest or say, if I never got the mail,
right,
I demanded it. And
tough luck. Yeah, they have a responsibility of trying to gauge the mail as far as when they could get something back. If they wait to the last moment and they live out in Gamble and the elections gets it on a Friday and they turn around and they send it on a Saturday, they don't get it by Tuesday, the simple answer is tough luck. But if you live in Gamble, I guess you got to think, boy, I better speed this. I'm going to have to back up 2 weeks. But what it does allow probably more people to physically get forms that are received between 10 days and 4 days, because those people, will probably get their absentee ballot in the mail.
That completes my question.
Mr. Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Pouchot, my concern is back on third-party candidates, and not really, I think you all made a good decision in the August 1st date of filing. I guess the underlying assumption is that the major party candidates that are required to file by June 1st may not meet the needs of all the voters, and people are dissatisfied with the choices, so they have the opportunity to run as candidates. I guess the problem I have, and was I guess maybe the unease I share with some of you all in the Senate, was the ability of third party candidates to file, and I guess all third party candidates have to have their petition signatures in order, but the idea of I don't have any problem with third-party candidates running. I do have a problem with people making up names, whether it be Bull Moose Republican or Working Class Democrat or whatever name they might choose. When those two parties don't exist, they're just like little labels to put on to garner votes on the ballot, I suppose. And when people sign those petitions for third-party candidacies, I think they're putting their trust in that person. But it just seems false and misleading to make up party names that are given the same standing on a ballot as a Democrat, Republican, Alaska Independent Party, Libertarian, established real political parties in our state. And so I'm wondering if you could, if you have any comments on that, and if those kinds of issues were considered in the Senate.
Well, as you might guess, there was lots of discussion on that. We have had members, like in the House, we've had members who have had moderate Republicans file against them as
that?
Republicans. So we did quite a bit of work on, we went to the AG's office, we went to our legal counsel, we researched some other national court cases. If I could kind of really generalize from that, it is basically unconstitutional to deny people labels that there are national, and one suggestion was, well, at least not use the word Democrat or Republican in the title. There are national recognized third parties called the Democratic Socialist Party of the United States. It became very problematic to try to distinguish between copycat names and bona fide names. And the other thing, and the other part of the equation, which you mentioned, well, how about, you know, a party of one, is that really a party? Some of that debate becomes like churches. Under, let's take a law, our tax-exempt license plates for nonprofit and religious organizations. If you go through that bill, or that the people who get YY plates, you will find churches of one all through there. And obviously there's a lot of Supreme Court history on that. You can't distinguish between churches of one or two versus, the Catholic Church in the United States. So it's constitutionally very problematic. We had no optimistic opinions on trying to address names or authenticity of political parties.
Further question?
It's vexing.
Mr. Martin?
Yeah, two major questions right now, and a couple of little ones for Lydia, but I won't bug the Senator on this. One of the problems I have, I told Max very early that this was going to come up in his race, and it did happen, and I've always objected to it because Republicans, ironically, were the ones that misused it. We have different requirements for a candidate dropping out of a race in the primary election versus the reason to drop out of the general election. And in a general election, after you win a primary race and you know what the opposition's going to be, then people can play games. Parties can play games. They find out, well, look, Martin, you're weak as heck, and we really don't think you're going to fare against Ms. Susie Q. So we want you to drop out for a number of reasons. We'll help you make up excuses. So drop out, and then we're going to put so-and-so in there to replace you. And Republicans won on that scheme a couple of years ago. About four elections ago. And it was a clear case where the weak candidate pulled out. The other candidate who was running for statewide office lost and was very good in his local area and won. Well, the same thing was almost pulled on Max. It was pulled, I think, or almost anyway. And I thought that was unfair because the requirements are different. The requirement is that you can withdraw just because you feel like withdrawn. In the primary race, it's very clear. You know, you're sick, you died. The party can put someone in your place. But there's a major difference, and I'd like to have that look into so that neither party can play games. And I was wondering if you had a chance to look at that, you know, the withdrawing.
You know, Representative Martin, I apologize. We did, you know, in the whole debate on all these provisions, we did not specifically look at that. I think you raise a legitimate, valid point. We didn't look at it.
It's totally unfair. It's just not right. I don't care if it's a Democrat, Republican, or more. The second one is that since it has been done, and if you it's nothing like experience to teach you a lesson, and it can happen both ways. Now, Kurt has his own reason for, you know, switching when he switched. But I do think that in order to protect the citizens, in order to protect the political party, who think they have legitimate candidates on their behalf, feel in exposition, that there should be some time element there. To be fair, just, you know, for whatever reason, wait until the very last second to switch party affiliation, and then the opposition party didn't have a fair chance. And of course, it completely circumvents the intent of the law to allow each party to have candidates. And when you don't have a candidate to begin with, and someone pulled that scheme, then it certainly circumvents the intent of a primary election, and certainly that each party will have a legitimate candidate. And I'd really like us to look into that one so that, for all fairness, people should know, parties should know who their candidates are and that they have all seats filled, and not some switch going on at the last second.
Mr. Chairman, we did have quite a discussion about that point in the Senate State Affairs Committee. And I think that, again, the bottom line of that whole debate was, yes, there's a lot of jockeying around in the last moment, but it's not clear ever. There's an offense, there's a defense, and anybody who's spent a little time on June 1st down at the Division of Elections knows that you can sit down there and watch the winds both ways, and that some of it is part of the political process in not just Alaska, but any state, and that parties that are concerned about probably should have people down watching the forms go by, along with the whole crowd that's down there anyway.
Mr. Chairman, I think on that point here, it's not the protection of the candidates and protection of us legislators. It's the public that should be protected. And that's the number one issue, that the public themselves and the citizens of both parties are protected from the possibility of being deprived of a legitimate candidate of their own party.
Mr. Chairman, not to be argumentative, but I chose my words very clearly. The party can station people down to protect its interests.
They were there, friend.
Do not concern. I would not confuse party interests with the public's interests. The public has a variety of candidates to choose from. If they want more candidates, they can file for office. You know, that's.
Do you have another question, Mr. Martin?
Yeah, on the 30-day requirement here by mail, I'm worried about a registrar who may at the mall or whatever, in open areas it's better, but they can run right down to the election bureau. But normally, they wait, they have a 5-day requirement in which to get their doggone things in. And I'm pleased I put that law in, because they used to hold them even up to election day before they put the things in, so the opposite candidate wouldn't get them. But does the registrar have to have all those ballots in before the 30th day, or can they come in 3 or 4 days later?
By the 30th day, they would have to be received by the Division of Elections.
No, she said no. Mm-hmm. Well, that's
pardon me, mailed.
Mailed, right. Well, a registrar then would
three days for the registrar.
Okay, you're going to comment, please, on the record.
Okay, on that, so we don't have a mix-up. I'm like Mr. Davis, I don't want the innocent person to slip through because some registrar didn't know the law or failed to register that person within the 30 days allocated. I think that's all right now, Mr. Chairman. I would have a couple for Mr. Ellsworth.
I think we're going to probably have to take 10.